you know, I talked to one of Bill's friends and in the book, and he said, you know, he doesn't hold grudges because grudges could be repaired. He holds death.
This is The Greg Cody Show with Greg Cody.
Pardon it.
Here's your host, Greg Cody.
Hello, all. I'm Greg Cody. I'm the guy they named this podcast after. And I'm a little bit down today because I just came from a funeral. What happened is in South Florida sports, we're burying our football teams. And there was a service at Hard Rock Stadium today where the Dolphins lost to the Colts 27-17. And all hell's breaking loose because this may be true in your hometown where your hometown team sucks, but the Dolphins, off a 10-win season, were expected to be really, really good. And they're 1-3, headed to 1-4, and they don't know what's going on. It seemed like a close game today. It was not. They really sucked. And that was a few days after the Hurricanes, also lost a huge home game. So all hell's breaking loose down here. We're having football funerals left, right, and center.
Greg, what type of funeral would you give a football team?
Oh, man. Well, we are all gathered here. You know, there were about 60,000
people. I mean, is it the traditional church funeral? Is it like in New Orleans where they do the second line parade, or is it more like a Viking funeral?
I don't know what a Viking funeral is, and we might reserve that for Minnesota because they never win big either lately. But it's definitely not a second line funeral in New Orleans because those are parties.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And neither the Hurricanes nor the Dolphins down here deserve a party right now. People want to fire Manny Diaz. People wonder how good Tua Tagovailoa is. They just lost to a winless team at home for the third straight loss. They're facing Tom Brady next in Tampa. It's crazy, which, by the way, I don't want to complain, but this coming weekend, I'm going to the Levitard Show roast Saturday night, and I forgot to book flights to Tampa the following morning. And so what's going to happen is I'm going to imbibe liberally and enjoy myself at the Levitard roast and then basically get up 3 hours later and drive 5 hours, 4.5 hours to Tampa in time to make a 1 o'clock game. So that's going to be tough on Greg Cody. I tell you that.
Are you going to stay at the Hard Rock or are you going to go home first?
I think I'm going to go home. That may be a bad idea. I should have booked a room at the HR, but I didn't even think of that either. I always say I need a personal secretary, and I really do because, you know, I'm just hopeless. I'm useless when it comes to taking care of my own business.
You literally have one in your pocket. Her name is Siri.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
File that under least surprising things in today's episode, folks.
Yeah, I just I don't know how to do that, let alone in my pocket. I mean, we have one of those things. It's not Siri, like Alexa or Alexis, whatever she's called.
Yeah, one of the Amazon home things. Yeah, I don't know what they're called either.
Yeah, I've got her in my kitchen. And occasionally I'll ask her to play a song or to give me a recipe. But I don't know anything else. I'm a Luddite. What can I tell you? But no, it's a sad scene down here in football. But we don't have a sad podcast. We have a fun, raucous podcast for you today. And why is that? What's fun about this, Yeti?
Oh, I mean, we've got talk about our high school years with some awkward dates.
Yep.
Seth Wickersham is going to be here to talk about his new book.
Oh, wow.
But really, I mean, like, how about this? How excited are you? We bring back Mount Gregmore.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. I am excited about the vaunted return of Greg Moore.
But another thing, HBO has sent us the final cut for episode 3 of Hard Knocks, Greg's Lobos. So how are the Lobos doing this week so far for week 4?
You know what? We're in it. We're competing. I'm not declaring victory, but because we're recording this Sunday evening, but we have a chance for our third straight win. As of us speaking right now, I am embroiled in a Donnybrook with my brother, the notorious Uncle Dick. And as of this second, we are projected to beat him 124-121. So it's much too close to declare victory.
Now, Greg, I've never played fantasy and everything still goes through Monday night, correct?
No, not everything. I mean, there's a chance that neither you nor the team you're playing will have anybody competing Monday night. So there's a, and even Sunday night's not always a given. There's a chance that, you know, some games are decided earlier Sunday, but for the most part, generally you're going into Sunday night or perhaps Monday night to determine a winner. So we can't say yet who's going to win, but we're optimistic, man. We're on a roll. We're headed toward a third win, I'll tell you that.
What's the origin of the phrase Donnybrook? Do you know?
I don't know, but it sure sounds like a guy's name, doesn't it? I mean, how many people on earth are named Donald Brook and they end up calling themselves Donnybrook?
We got it's a Donnybrook.
Yeah, that's right.
So what exactly does it mean? Because I've heard it, but I actually don't know.
You know, it's one of those phrases that I use occasionally without really knowing the origin of it. I just know that it means... you know, like a, just like a real intense battle or like a competitive thing where you don't know how it's going to turn out.
Did a young Greg Cody have this similar habit? Like, were you walking up to your mom and dad at six and were like, I'm in a real boner over here, mom?
I don't know that I ever said the word boner in front of my mother. I have to say that, but I was the kind of kid who, young in life, would use a word like Donnybrook or brouhaha. You know, I was that kind of guy. I got a little Chris Whittingham in me. You know, I enunciate, I'm erudite when I'm in the mood to be, and I'm not bragging. That's just sort of one of my foibles. And there's another word, foible.
Hey, yeah, I love a good foible. I use that word all the time. Although I'm not sure if we're losing the audience with all this vocabulary talk.
Yep. Enough talk about language. Let's get into Hard Knocks, Greg's Lobos, episode 3.
Elated by consecutive victories, Greg surprises the Lobos by skipping the bar and opting for a more classic celebratory treat.
My Lobos, I've always been a big believer in celebrating a big win in the right way. And after we won our second game in a row, this is what I envisioned for our team. And here we are at a long table. We all got bowls of ice cream and cones and sundaes in front of us. The good folks at Dairy Queen have really set us up. And this is the place to be to celebrate with a team party after a big win. I'm looking around right now. I'm wondering why the hell Dairy Queen's got hot dogs on the menu. I have no idea. You got to know your role, Dairy Queen. This is an ice cream joint. And Godert, you've already had about 4 cones. 2 of them I saw you inhale in 1 bite. Keep it soft on that. Zeke, I got you at the head of the table for a couple of reasons so I can see it. Number one, you're the MVL, man. You came through. 26 points on Monday night gave us that big win. MVL, Zeke, you've also had a little problem with the LBs, so let's keep it to 1 scoop if you don't mind. Am I right, L Jack? I know you're disciplined over there. You got and Jamar Chase, my rookie. You didn't start the first game, and that was the best move I've made as a head coach so far is putting you in my flex spot. You've been terrific. And Jamar, I got to be honest with you. I've never in my life seen anybody put ketchup on a sundae before. But, buddy, you can put sawdust on it for all I care if you keep scoring and crossing that goal line like you've been doing. Good work. And we just want to celebrate the way you should celebrate. This brings me back to my youth football day, youth football, where my coach would take us to a team party at a Dairy Queen. And we got it coming full circle right now. This is the Lobo way. Enjoy yourselves, guys. You earned it.
Later, at Greg's Lobos training facility, Greg grows concerned that the team's recent success may open the door for the corruptive seed of pride.
Gentlemen, we're going into this next game off 2 big wins in a row. And I know the psychology of sports better than anybody. And I'm going to tell you, we're poised right now, if we're not careful, to go into this game with a big head, a big team head, overconfidence, particularly because we look to kick the ass of our next opponent between you and I. That's just in this room. But listen, so we don't go into this game with a big head, I brought in a special guest today. It's Dexter Dinwiddie, who you may all know as the Guinness World Record holder for the smallest head. Now, Dexter knows what it's like to go through life even keeled, not worried about having a big head, and I want him to say a few words to you guys. Dexter, welcome. Welcome. Come on in. Come on over here. How you doing? Got trouble finding hats, or how does that work? All right, here's Dexter.
Guys, I've gone through life never having to worry about having a big head. And you know what? Even though some people might make fun of me, I think it's the way to go. Because I never have to worry about overconfidence. I always have to worry about doing my job, doing my due diligence, not taking anything for granted. And you guys are in that position right now, okay? I know you got helmets to hide it, but I want you to trot onto that field imagining that that helmet is rattling around on top of a small head like mine. Okay, guys? I've been a big fan of yours for a long time. I got all the faith in the world for you. Go get them today with small heads. Small heads.
Small heads. Small heads. Small heads. Small heads. Small heads. Small heads. Small heads.
Gregory, I have something I need to talk to you about.
Uh-oh.
We played golf a couple days ago. Me, you, Mike Ryan, Stu Gatz. And
fun.
Somehow, now we can get to that. You can talk some golf if you want. But there was like a casual comment you made that I was like, I'm going to bring this up on the podcast.
Oh, no.
Somehow, okay. Somehow something prom came up. Something about prom night. And I was like, Dad, it dawned on me that I don't think I'd ever asked you before. I was like, Dad, did you go to your prom? And you were like, it's a long story. So I was like, you know what? This seems like something that would be perfect to the podcast. So I want you to tell the, like, what is the long, and keep it tight. You know, we don't need it to be too long. But what happened? What is the Greg Cody prom story?
Well, the Greg Cody prom story in Reader's Digest version is that there was no prom because Greg Cody in high school was pretty much antisocial and didn't have a lot of friends, let alone a girlfriend. No, I had guy friends and girlfriends, but not a girlfriend.
This has gotten sad. This has gotten sad really, really quick.
Did you spend prom night with Paul Radke?
Seriously, did you play Strat-O-Matic baseball on prom night?
No, not that I recall. I wasn't that pathetic, although high school still was the Strat-O-Matic era for me. So I was probably playing Strat-O-Matic instead of going to a prom.
It's just hilarious. So there's really no story behind it. You just had a sad, non-existent prom.
Yes, that's correct. I don't even remember where my prom was held. Like, I don't know if it was in way back in the day. I think they held proms in like school gymnasiums. I don't know if they still do that or not. Nowadays, it's probably at some fancy club.
So there was no rejection. No, they're not at clubs. Okay. I don't know what you're talking about. So there was no rejection involved with this. So you didn't ask somebody and get rejected. You just like didn't partake at all.
No, I didn't.
I'm like throwing stones here. I actually had a sad prom experience. I ended up getting a pity invite from like a girlfriend of mine, like wasn't dating. There was nothing like that. It was just kind of like she noticed a couple weeks out, like, you don't have a date. We were just like talking in class.
Right.
She's like, I'll go with you. I'm like, okay. And it was just like, yeah. So like mine's pretty sad as well. I actually did go, you know,
right.
But it was kind of like a pity invite. Like we didn't dance. Like I like was just kind of like there. It was awkward.
I do remember that. Didn't we rent a limousine for you? Or was
Like all the pre pictures were at our house. So it was like awkward. She came over. I gave her a corsage. We took a picture together. And then it was just like, this is nothing. So Yeti, I hope you had a better prom experience than my dad and I, because this is not the Cody men have had some sad proms. We should recreate a prom. Let's recreate a prom, Dad, so me and you can have a better experience.
Yeah, let's do that. I like that idea.
The Greg's Lowboat sponsored prom.
There you go.
The PFPI prom and gala.
Exactly.
.com. I had fun on both. I went junior and senior
year. Did you go? So you went and you went with someone you were like a girlfriend. Like, did you actually go with
no
someone?
No girlfriend. Okay. Interested in, but no girlfriend.
So you went solo?
No, I had dates. Okay. My junior year, I took one of the senior girls out, which was awesome. And
look at you.
And then my senior year, I took one of the sophomore girls out. I had crushes on both when I asked them, but you know they didn't reciprocate. But we still had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Now, there was a whole group of people who were going, and they had a friend who didn't have a date, and they tried to invite me to go to take her out. I'm like, I'm not going to take somebody out of pity.
Yeah.
And so I didn't. And the rumor has it is that group ended up in what one might call a light orgy by the end of the night. And wow. Which was good. I wasn't there because I would have been crying in the corner. What? So, you know,
this, I was about to say you had a sad prom experience as well, but things took a turn late in the night. So that was good for you.
Wow.
Yeah. I would have ended up crying in the corner. It would have been horrific for me.
It's such a funny visual of an orgy taking place and Yeti in the corner weeping. It's not a visual that I expected to have today, but I'm glad that I have it.
We can all agree that my non-prom experience was by far the most pathetic of all of them. I was probably home.
Maybe of all time.
Yeah, I was probably home watching All in the Family with my parents on prom night, if I remember correctly.
Why were you so insecure as a kid and keeping to yourself? Why didn't you get out there? Make some friends.
Yeah. When I look back on it, I was slow developing physically. When I graduated from high school, I swear I probably weighed 135 pounds. I was a small kid. I grew a lot late, in college and everything. So I don't know. I just, when I look back on my youth, I do sort of regret not being more social. You know, I mean, I wasn't antisocial. I remember going on a double date once with a guy and two twins, actually. Now that I think about you marrying a twin.
Wow.
Went on a double date with a friend of mine and two twins. So it's not like I was always home playing Stratomatic, but generally.
Was the double date awkward where the guy and the other twin had obvious chemistry and you were just awkwardly sitting with the other twin?
That's so close to the truth. That, I mean, they're in the front seat, making out and everything. And,
oh, man.
And you're like, do you play Stratomatic? Who's your Stratomatic team?
What do you think of Yaz?
Yeah, that's right. Carly Strumsky was my date for the senior prom. As a matter of fact. No, it's, enough about my pathetic life. I did grow up to be a very sensitive person.
Group dates can be hard. I went on one, and this just must be a Greg thing, but I went on with two of my friends. We had met these girls at a youth conference at church. And so we drove down to High Point, which is about an hour south of us. And they didn't have the third, but for me, but they invited their friend Nancy to come over. And so we're like, we'll all go to this 4th of July celebration. It's out by a lake. The sun's setting. Hope Floats was the movie of the summer. So Garth Brooks's To Make You Feel My Love was the hit song of the summer. And,
why do I have this at a drive-in movie theater? I don't know.
It was a similar setting, but it was a little outdoor. It was at a lakeside concert for the 4th of July.
There you go.
And the sun's setting over the lake, and Nancy sees some friends from school, and she gets up and leaves me. And we didn't see her the rest of the night. And so I'm in the middle. My cousin Taylor's on one side. Our friend Justin's on another. They're both making out. And I'm just kind of staring straight up into the sky, just
classic
pretending
Nancy.
That I'm not there.
Classic
yeah,
Nancy.
Yeah, thanks,
are we still
Nancy.
Are we still making Nancy's?
No.
That seems like a name. That seems like someone might. That seems like somebody's name that my dad dated in high school. I did not have Nancy.
Nancy.
Nancy's were a thing.
But yeah, after that experience, I was known as the wall because I was the wall in between the two people making out while I was just sitting there, lying back and dreaming of
people
England.
Making out need a wall. So you provided that. Dad, we mentioned golf before. Before we get to Wickersham, it needs to be said on the record that you hold one out from 130 yards.
I did.
On the 10th hole when we were playing golf. I have never done that. I'm a much better golfer than you.
Right.
I've never made, I think the most I've chipped in is maybe 30 yards, 40 yards. But it was, and we were playing match play and you guys were down on the hole.
Yep.
And you essentially needed to hole out to win the hole. You were 130 yards out. I was walking up to the green to just get my ball because I'm if he doesn't literally hold us out,
right,
we win the hole.
Right.
And I'm literally up by the hole. He hits it and I'm like, oh my God, that looks good. Oh, wow, that's some good pace. That can't go in. There's no, it's going to hit, it's going to lip out right in the cup. 130 yards. We end up losing the hole.
It was so far away that I couldn't even see the putt drop.
You saw my reaction.
Or the shot, rather. Yeah.
You saw my reaction because I was up there. It was insane. Such a cool moment. Mike Ryan, Stu Gatz, we're all going crazy. Oh, man, you're terrible at golf, but those shots bring you back.
Was that your greatest shot ever?
Oh, it has to be.
I think that was the shot of my life. Yeah.
Well, it's the best result ever because you honestly didn't even hit it that great. It's one of those things where you'd rather be lucky than good.
Right.
You'd agree. You hit a sand shot that was actually probably better just in terms of quality of shot.
That's true.
You know what I mean? With that shot, you have to get lucky to make something from 130 yards out.
No, you're right. But it did feel really good. And I remember it was so far out and we needed to make it to have the hole. And I remember Stu Gatz basically telling me, don't even bother.
Yeah.
Like, why are you even taking this shot? And as I'm taking the shot, he's saying that. And then it goes in. That was fantastic. I have to say, I played pretty well until my fourth Bloody Mary.
Oh, my God.
At that point, it went downhill.
Most people, because we started at, like, you know, 10 a.m., so it was flowing a little early on Friday. And Greg stayed with the Bloody Mary. Usually you start with a Bloody Mary, then you work, get a little water, get some beer. But, like, my dad was just like, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody. And by the back nine, he was seeing three holes.
Well, the first three went down so easy. I shouldn't have had the fourth because I'm literally why we ended up losing.
Yes.
Because I was playing much better than Mike. Stu Gatz and I were actually a really good team.
Yes.
But then the fourth Bloody Mary kicked it.
I was pissed. With four holes left, me and Mike were down two holes. I never lose these best ball competitions with when I'm playing with a bunch of, you know, not to be an elitist, but like I'm like clearly the best golfer in the group. And my dad's pulling one, hitting shots in the hole from 130 out of his ass, hitting sand shots I've never seen him hit before. He played so great on the back nine.
Right.
But then, like he said, the Bloody Marys kicked in. And then
yeah, I was also chipping pretty well, which I
know.
Did.
It's tarot's insane.
Yeah, no, that round actually gave me hope. You know, I think I'm still getting better at my age. I'm getting better at golf.
You're not.
Yeah.
Dad, there's been, you know, talk in our group chats. You're not happy with the amount of Mount Gregmores lately. Let's go ahead. Before we get to Seth Wickersham, get your damn Mount Gregmore out of the way so you don't, like, you know, boycott the podcast.
Okay. Here comes another Mount Gregmore. And as the calendar flips from September to October, today we bring you the Mount Gregmore of songs with a month in the title. How about that?
You seem excited about this segment today. I'm happy.
Oh, I'm so excited. We haven't done it in a while. This is like my baby, and finally I get to
rock my
baby.
You know what? I'm excited. I'm excited about this segment now. You just got me. I hate this segment, but I can't wait to hear which songs with months in the title.
How about that? And by the way, it has to be a month. Example, May is the name of a month, but the great Rod Stewart song Maggie May refers to May as a name, not a month, so that would not be included.
Semantics.
Okay, first, our honorable mention, Wake Me Up When September Ends by the former favorite band of either Christopher or Michael, I can never remember, Green Day.
Michael.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I mean, I like Green Day, but they're never my favorite.
Okay, number five, September Morn by Neil Diamond. And yes, that's morn, not morning, for a lugubrious, mournful song.
I don't know that song. Sing it.
September Morn.
All right.
Eddie, do you know that song?
I don't know that song.
Okay. I literally could not sing anything except the two-word title.
Bra-da-dee, da-da-dee.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Number four, November Rain by Guns N' Roses, in which Axl Rose does the near impossible by screaming a ballad. Number three.
That's a good one. That takes a young Yeti back to sixth grade.
Wow.
Third person.
Number three, April 29th, 1992 by Sublime. I loved Sublime for a time.
That's the name of the song?
Yeah, April 29th, 1992.
Do they say that in the song at some point? It's like a weird lyric to get into a song.
I think they do. Yeah, actually.
All right.
I think
McCartney's got a whole song called 1985. So, I mean.
Yeah, but that's at least just like one. Like, you know, this is like a whole date. Anyways, keep going.
Okay, by the way, when I loved Sublime, it was the original Sublime with Bradley Nowell, not the facsimile called Sublime with Rhyme, with Rome. Sublime with Rhyme. I want to make that very clear. Number two. Number two, this is the one you've all been waiting for. September by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
That's the one.
Featuring lead singer and Greg Cody Show alumni guest, Philip Bailey.
Do you remember?
Excellent.
September.
Yeah. All right. And now, the number one song with a month in the title.
I am so excited to hear number one. Like, look at me right now. Look at my face. Yeah. I could not be more excited to hear what number one is.
You exude excitement. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if September is number two, I can only imagine how amazing number one is.
And it is. The number one song with a month in the title, December 1963 by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Oh, what a night.
Okay.
Late September. September back in 63.
Oh, what a night.
Oh, what a night. Yeah.
How about that? And there you have
There's some excitement.
Yeah.
There you have it, another acclaimed edition of Mount Greg Moore.
I missed that. That was fun.
How about that?
Now let's get to some more fun with Seth Wickersham.
Wicking it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We're really pleased to be speaking with ESPN senior writer Seth Wickersham, who on October 12th, next week, has a new book coming out that everybody's heard of by now. It's called It's Better to Be Feared. And it's the story of how would you describe it? It's the story of the dynasty and how it ended, really, right, with the Patriots.
Yeah, I mean, the best way I could describe it is I think that I did the very best I could to get at what made Tom Brady and Bill Belichick so great at this profession that's in which greatness is inherently fleeting, right? I mean, it never lasts long. And then what were the costs of that greatness? I mean, those are the things that I tried my best to write about and report, and that's the story I tried to tell.
Right. And the early indications are it's a terrific book. I just got a copy of it in the mail delivered yesterday. So in all truth, I haven't had a chance to fully read it yet and really look forward to doing so. Comes out October 12th. It's a fascinating trilogy you're writing about, because it's not just Brady and Belichick, who just played Sunday in their first meeting as rivals, but also, of course, the owner, Robert Kraft, is a part of this whole trilogy as well. Getting to know them over the years, I wonder if you would talk individually about all three and what kind of people they are, because as public as they are, there's a certain secretiveness to each of them, I think. And like for me, on the outside looking in, Bill Belichick never seemed very likable to me. And I wonder, is he a likable guy when you know him, or is he the curmudgeon in private that he appears to be in public?
Yeah, he's both, right? They had that one line once where Bob Dylan was in a movie and he asked the director what to do. And the director was like, well, just be yourself. And Dylan said, well, which one? The question is that, you know, the answer is that these guys are all those things. But I think that, let's just start with Robert Kraft. I mean, I think that Robert Kraft, the masterful thing that he did was keep this thing together and keep two very strong personalities able to work together and work at a very successful rate. I think that Robert Kraft, he's idealistic. He's a friend to the league, and he's a loyal owner to the league. He has a ruthless streak, like many owners do. And, you know, I think that, again, where his talents kind of came in, number one, he made probably the greatest trade in NFL history when he traded for Bill Belichick, but he kept these guys together. And that didn't mean that it didn't occasionally, you know, require some, you know, managerial hard work. I have this one scene in the book that I write about in Aspen in 2018, where he's at a conference, at a business conference, and he's in the hotel lobby. And he says, you know, I hate leaving a place like this. You meet some of the most brilliant minds here, and I have to go to Detroit to be with the biggest effing a-hole in my life, my head coach. Only he didn't use the word effing, he didn't use the word a-hole.
Right.
And then we'll move on to Bill Belichick. I think that with Bill Belichick, he's introverted, he's quirky, he's so smart and so hardworking. And, you know, one of the things I really try to get at in the book is just what's it like working with him and working for him? And what, you know, with days that start at 4:30 and meetings where he, you know, that last for hours, where he's checking for any loose screw. And, you know, the way that he became this kind of cultural presence in a way, both with his style of dress and with his mannerisms and with his work ethic. And, you know, I think that Bill Belichick also has a ruthless streak, and that's pretty well documented. And but I think at the end of the day, you know, he learned at an early age that early in his coaching career, that he needed to kind of kill what made him weak. And, you know, everybody's always wondering, like, well, how can he, you know, make these ruthless moves all the time? Yes, they're in the best interest of the team, but, you know, what's it worth if all of these relationships are broken, you know, and
right.
And you've no one to kind of be around who, you know, you always have these elephants in the room and all these relationships. And, you know, I think that he became resolutely fixed in, like, you know, the type of person he needed to be a successful head coach, learning from Paul Brown and learning from Bill Walsh and Bill Parcells and taking it to the nth degree. And then you have Tom Brady, who, you know, he's very earnest. He's got a big temper. That's one of the things I get at in there. And he's so proud of his mental toughness. And one of the things I write about in the book, I try to show how that came to be. And there was a moment at Michigan when he was there and he was buried on the depth chart and didn't see a way out. And he met with his counselor, Greg Hardin. And he told Greg Hardin that he had just told Lloyd Carr, the head coach, that he was going to transfer back to Cal. And his counselor, you know, started to laugh at him. Like, he didn't say, oh, no, Tom, please don't go. He started to laugh. And he said, no one's going to miss you if you leave. You haven't done anything here anyway.
Wow.
You want to leave, go ahead. And I think that that really solidified with Brady is like, look, I want to, like, make it in the big leagues. I don't want to take the easier route. And that's part of what made him, you know, so mentally tough over the years.
Seth, I wonder, what are an example or two of Brady's temper? And I wonder if you've ever been on the receiving end of it.
No, he mostly reserves it for games. But, you know, he used to play golf with his dad as a kid. And when he was missing shots, he would throw the clubs, he would cuss, he would swear. At one point, his dad sent him home. You know, it was like, this is not how we act. But if you look at him now, you know, obviously he's grown up and he's matured, but you still see that rage in a weird way. Like, it never goes away. Last year when the Bucs were playing the Bears on Thursday Night Football, I think they ended up in something like a 4th-and-27. And he was so mad and he was cussing out his offensive line on the sideline. And I have, you know, the exact words that he used in there. And it's probably not best for this show, but the readers can read it. But, you know, it's interesting because it's like, even though he's changed as a person and he's become more of a positive thinker and, you know, into defying age and everything, he still has that rage that he had as a kid when he was, you know, fighting for that legitimacy alongside his dad.
I would pay for a video of Tom Brady petulantly throwing a club into a lake after after a duff shot. That would be fabulous. If anybody has that, please email it to me. Seth Wickersham, new book coming out, ESPN senior writer. The book is It's Better to Be Feared. The title of the book, does that come from a direct quote from anyone, or is that, what is the genesis of how you named the book?
You know, I think it was a thematic title. It didn't come out of a quote. It was just that if you look at their run, you know, there's some people who just want to be loved by the greater populace, and especially Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, you know, that was never their thing. I think that they enjoyed all the adulation. And then when Spygate hit in 2007, you know, they saw how quickly, you know, the public at large could turn on them and their accomplishments could be called into question. And so from that point on, they kind of didn't care if they ever came off as jerks or running up the score on people, whatever. I mean, they wanted respect and they wanted to be feared and more than they wanted to be loved. And that's, you know, that was the themes that I thought kind of made the title work.
Right. One of the fascinating things about the way it ended is that it's in the book that Tom Brady wanted to say goodbye in person with Belichick, which you would figure after such a long, successful relationship. But that Belichick basically said, geez, I'm not available. Let's do it by phone, which is astonishing to me. Belichick this last week in his Wednesday press conference sort of denied that. He said that was not what happened. I wonder if you could sort of underline what you wrote and what you think about Belichick denying it.
Well, sure. The anecdote really had nothing to do with Bill. I mean, it's well documented that they talked on the phone and that it was a good conversation. I never implied that Belichick was unavailable for any nefarious reasons or whatever. I just wrote that night, you know, Brady said goodbye to Bill over the phone. And that night he told a very close confidant that, you know, he thought it was telling that they ended up speaking speaking on the phone and not in person, telling of the state of their relationship. So that was the genesis of it. And when Tom was asked about it, he did a great job of not denying it and also not giving anything more away.
Right. Belichick and Brady met Sunday as adversaries for the first time after winning 6 Super Bowls together. And the book is so perfectly timed to come out just after that that historic first meeting between the two of them. What did you imagine looking at that first meeting, the emotion of those two guys? You know, they're both probably going to say after the fact that it was just another game, but when obviously it wasn't. Knowing Belichick and Brady as you do, what do you think that they brought into that first meeting in terms of just anger for each other, wanting to beat each other in a way that that they probably don't accept in Super Bowls? What do you think the emotion was going in for those guys?
Well, there's two levels to it, right? There's obviously the competitive emotion, and that's undeniable. You know, these two, for as different as they are, they have a lot of things in common. They have some shared traits that I really think like helped their relationship and their tenure together last as long as it did. And one of them, I think, is kind of interesting, is that they're both real, they're optimists. Like, they come at it at different angles, but nobody in NFL history has believed in the potential and the power of the next play and the next game like these two. And you see it, you know, playing out on international stages. Tom Brady down 28-3 to the Falcons and finding a way to come back. All of the unbelievable goal line stands that Bill Belichick's defenses have had over the years. These two just refuse to concede an inch.
Right.
And they always find a way to believe. So you have that, and that competitive aura that they both possess. And then you have the practicalness of Sunday's game, and that's that both men needed a win. Both teams lost, you know, the week prior. And so from a practical level, both of these guys kind of needed a win.
Seth, we're a Miami-based podcast, as you probably know, and Dolphin fans down here have always had a sort of what I'd call a hate relationship with the dynastic Patriots. And so I think the book's going to be a big seller down here. And when you look at the relationship that Belichick and Brady had toward the very end, what drove Brady out? Is it as simple as saying that Belichick and Kraft simply would not commit to having Brady as their quarterback several more years?
Yes, I do. I think that from the moment they beat the Falcons in the Super Bowl, so that's February of 2017, you know, Brady felt like they had accomplished something unprecedented, 5 Super Bowls together. And because of that, you know, he should be treated a little bit differently than he already was. And he had made very clear his public desire to play until he was 45 years old. And really, the last couple of years in New England, that was the main source of a lot of the problems. Just the Patriots refused to commit to him that long. And it wasn't just Bill Belichick, even though Robert Kraft, you know, wanted Brady to retire a Patriot. You know, it was an organizational decision. At the Super Bowl down in Miami, when the Chiefs played the 49ers, Kraft told another owner that, you know, we want Tom, but not until he's age 45.
Right.
All that said, there are all these other things too. And that's that after 20 years of, you know, gaining, you know, becoming an astute football mind, I think that Tom Brady wanted to be a little bit more than just a quarterback. And, you know, to have some influence on personnel, to have some influence on game planning. I mean, he knows more about offensive football than most head coaches in the NFL.
Right.
And, you know, to have a little bit more of an imprint around the organization. And that was just never going to happen in New England. He told Joe Montana at one point, you know, they ask my opinion, I give it, and then they ignore it.
Right.
And in Tampa, it's just much different. I mean, Alex Guerrero, his business partner and body coach, who Bill Belichick once banned from the team playing in the sideline and part of the building, has an office in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers facility, and he got a Super Bowl ring.
Nice.
So I think that tells you all you need to know about Tom Brady's influence around the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Wow.
In the book, you reference Belichick's adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
Does that adaptability stay on the field? And is that one of the things that probably helped lead to the demise as well?
I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, I think that Bill Belichick's ideology is his lack of ideology, and that's what makes him so special. You know, in 2001, for instance, they played a 3-4 defense. And even though Bill Belichick had mostly run a 3-4 defense throughout his career, he wasn't playing a 3-4 because that was the ideology he was stuck in. It was because everybody else in the league was playing a 4-3 and he could get 3-4 players at a discount. And so he's just incredibly adaptable. And he, you know, Alex Guerrero came out a couple of weeks ago and he said, you know, Bill didn't evolve to account for, you know, what Tom Brady had become. And, you know, I don't think that's quite fair. But at the end of the day, this was letting Tom Brady leave turned out to be a stunningly poor personnel decision. And the two people, Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick, who should have known better than anybody than to underestimate Tom Brady, did just that.
I want to know how. I listened to your interview with Pablo Torre on ESPN Daily, and he said this book is like over 500 pages, and he specifically said there's no fat. How do you get this much access that no one else seems to be able to get?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. You know, one of my very first stories at ESPN Magazine was on Tom Brady. We were the same age, and it was 2001, and at the time, you know, he didn't even know if he'd be finishing the season as a starter. And so, you know, we all know how that went. And so in a weird way, it's like their dominance, you know, I had not exactly a front row seat because I wasn't covering every game, but, you know, I got to know these guys over the course of those years. And if there's a journalistic lesson in it, it's never throw away a notebook. You never know when they might come in handy, but I was able to draw from those experiences. You know, I'd rather have those moments with Tom Brady where I was with him in 01, 02, 03, 04, 05 at his parties, at his house, you know, into, you know, 2015, you know, these moments along the way, then sitting down with him for an hour for the book and trying to get, you know, 20 years of material out of him in 1 hour. I felt like that, like I just had a unique, you know, things that I had witnessed and things that I had been told. And then you couple that with the fact that you do this for a long time, you just get to know people around the league and you get to know people around the building. And so you end up having both the Rolodex and the experience firsthand from these moments. And so I felt really good about my ability to just, you know, write the story that I tried to write as best I could.
We also would have accepted the answer, I'm just that damn good.
You know, it's not that though. You know, it's just, it's that there's just a lot of it. One of the things you realize, and it's kind of a theme in the book, is luck. You know, I mean, it takes some luck to be that good. And if Tom Brady had been drafted by the Arizona Cardinals, would he have been Tom effing Brady? I don't think so. And if Bill Belichick had not picked Tom Brady, would he be Bill Belichick? Of course not. And so, you know, I think that there was just some luck along the way that I got, you know, back in 2001, I got assigned that Tom Brady piece and I met with him and, you know, it was the start of a relationship.
Seth, with that in mind, I was surprised that none of the principals wanted to speak to you specifically for this book, that they're quoted richly throughout the book, but it's from past interviews and such. Why is that? Because you had a good relationship with each of them. Why do you think it is that they preferred not to be involved in this book?
Well, I've done some stories over the years that were controversial at the time and that they didn't necessarily like at the time, but proved to be accurate.
Sure.
And so I think as a journalist, you do your best to manage relationships. But as we've learned, and as the book details, these guys are okay ending relationships.
Right.
If it doesn't suit their need. You know, I talked to one of Bill's friends and in the book, and he said, you know, he doesn't hold grudges because grudges could be repaired. He holds death. There is no chance. There's no chance of reconciliation.
I like it. Yeah, there is a ruthless quality to Belichick, that's for sure. And there's a dark side to the dynasty, obviously. I wonder, and I'm referring to the controversies, Spygate, Deflategate, the idea that at least one or two teams have been involved with having their practices videotaped by the Patriots, reportedly. What is, when the obituary of this dynasty is written, how much weight do we need to give to those controversies? And is it fair in any way to say that to a degree the Patriots sort of cheated their way to what they accomplished?
Well, to be clear, there's been a lot of suspicion and investigations about tape practices, and it's never been proven. But they broke the rules for 7 years with Spygate, and they were videotaping signals from the sideline, and they were doing it covertly, and it was practiced, and it was something that they, you know, did for years. And, you know, even though teams around the league knew about it, you know, and it ended up coming out in a weird way because Eric Mangini goes to the Jets, and he knew that they did this, and he was sick of it. And he and Bill Belichick had been in a pissing match since he had left New England. And so, you know, Eric Mangini's telling people in the building, he's pissing in my face with this. He tells the New England Patriots, I know you do this. Stop it. Cut it out.
Right.
And they didn't stop it. And he just felt like that Bill was just being a jerk. And it was the upper management of the Jets that blew the whistle on it. Eric never wanted it to become as big a deal as it did. That said, it became a huge deal. It started a senatorial investigation, and it was a huge black mark for the league and for the Patriots. And the way that the league handled it, destroying the tapes. You know, I have this scene in this book that Don Van Natt and I reported on years ago, where the general counsel for the NFL, Jeff Pasch, is in a conference room in Foxborough, Massachusetts, and he's literally stomping the videotapes to pieces and then leaves them on the floor for the Patriots general counsel to clean up. But, you know, the way that that happened, it became a huge problem. And obviously the Patriots responded to that with another unprecedented run of excellence. But there's always going to be people who think that, you know, this deserves a black mark. And I think that you can tell that it was a big deal because years later, when Tom Brady was investigated for deflating footballs or allegedly deflating footballs, a ridiculous investigation that became an international story, Bill Belichick initially kind of put it in Tom Brady's lap and was like, I didn't know anything about this. Tom's going to have to speak to it.
Right.
And I think it was because he knew that he could not have another cheating scandal on his resume. It might keep him out of the Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah, and I think that's worth exploring because when you write the life story of Bill Belichick, how high up in that story do you have to mention the controversies? And I ask you that as a journalist, I'm sort of conflicted about it. I mean, you think first of the success and the Super Bowls and the relentless winning over almost 20-year period, but the other stuff is real. It happened, and it's part of who he is and what he's accomplished. And how much weight do we give that?
It's a great question. I mean, the NFL never did a real investigation. They never tried to determine, you know, really how long they were taping these signals and how many games it helped them in. They never really did it. And I have this scene in the book where Spygate breaks and Roger Goodell is trying to learn about Spygate as fast as he can to assess a punishment. And he calls Mike Shanahan, who was with the Denver Broncos, and all of the coaches that he had called were just piling on Belichick. You know, it was the height of piousness. Right. He calls Mike Shanahan, and Mike Shanahan says, Roger, I wish I had thought to do this. And I'm disappointed in myself that I didn't. And I think that it really showed just how competitive and you know, where the lines are and how they're able to be moved for the very top at this incredibly competitive and ruthless profession.
Right.
How high you mention with Bill, I mean, outside of New England, it's probably going to get mentioned pretty high. In New England, I think it would get mentioned a little bit lower. But, you know, look, there's no question that it happened. And there's also no question, though, that they responded with almost an undefeated season. And, you know, an 18-0 season that became 18-1 with 2 minutes to go in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's it is amazing to think about that. And it likewise, Brady leaves Belichick and immediately wins the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
What do you think that did to Belichick, who, you know, better than just about anybody, when he sees Brady marching to a Super Bowl win while he's having his first losing season in about 150 years, how does Belichick react to that privately, do you think?
Well, I look, it was a black mark on both Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft that they let that happen. And, you know, I think that Bill did some uncharacteristic things in 2020. You know, he's somebody who's never made excuses. But as they were losing, and as it was clear that, you know, this Patriots team was going to finally come back down to earth a little bit, I mean, they were still 7-9. It wasn't like they went 1-15.
Right.
But when it was clear that this wasn't one of those special teams, he said publicly, look, we sold out. And we won 3 Super Bowls and made it to another and made it to an AFC championship game. And, you know, we needed a year to kind of reset. And, you know, I thought that was a really telling comment. He also had said, look, everything we did over the past 20 years was what was best for Tom Brady. And I thought that was just interesting because someone who never made excuses kind of sounded like he was making excuses, even though he said, these aren't excuses, these are just facts.
If we're speaking with Seth Wickersham, whose new book, It's Better to Be Feared, the story of the Patriots dynasty, is coming out October 12th. And Seth, we're going to let you go in a minute. But I'm wondering if, and this is conjecture I'm asking you for, but if Kraft and Belichick can turn back the clock 2 or 3 years, do they give Brady what he wanted, knowing that his performance was going to remain, you know, as high as ever into his mid-40s?
Well, okay, I'll answer that in two hypothetical ways. I think number one is, if they knew they were going to get another Super Bowl out of it, of course. You know, I mean, that's a bottom line. I mean, an eighth Super Bowl, are you kidding me? Or I'm sorry, a seventh Super Bowl for that group, are you kidding me? But I think that Brady needed something new. And would they have won a Super Bowl? I don't know. You know, I mean, he managed for a long time last year. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were a good team, but they didn't look like a great one. And I mentioned that steadfast belief that Brady and Belichick share. You saw that takeover where Tom Brady basically took over the offense and the team in December and into January. And that's how they were able to come together and do it. I don't know if that magic would have happened in New England. I think that at the end of the day, he was kind of, ready to see if there was another way to do this, knowing that no one could ever take away what he did in New England. And he needed something new.
Is there anything funny in the book? Because it's a pretty serious book overall, but what's the funny in it?
Well, I think there's a lot of funny things. I wrote about these guys as characters. And so there's always going to be funny moments as characters. But like, you know, I've got, a funny scene where some of the coaches rigged Belichick's computer so that as soon as he turned it on, it was screaming porn. And you could hear the porn down the hallway. And Bill didn't know how to turn off his computer. And so he's banging the keyboard and he's cussing and he's swearing and the coaches are just dying laughing. Finally, he gets under the desk and just unplugs the entire thing because he can't figure out a way to get it to turn off. And you know, Tom Brady bringing Giselle's dog into the Patriots facility in a Louis Vuitton bag. And he's like, can I hide the dog in someone's office? Because I can't let the guys see that I'm supposed to be taking care of Giselle's dog this day. And of course, everyone found out about it and they gave him a hard time about it. But, I don't think that it's a studious read. I hopefully think that it's an entertaining one. It has a lot of moments that'll make people smile and a lot of moments that'll make people think.
Well, Seth, I wish you all the luck in the world with the book. It comes out October 12th. It's your first book. And I wonder, what are your emotions as the book's about to drop? Are you nervous? how does it feel?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a nervousness and a little bit of a relief, but it's mostly fun because I get to talk to legends like you.
Seth, we will let you go on that note of you lying and complimenting me like that. It's a beautiful dismount. And we wish you all the luck in the world with the book.
It was a real pleasure to be here with you guys, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth. Appreciate it. We want to thank Seth Wickersham. That was good stuff. And
you're literally holding the book. Look at you.
I can't wait to read it. It's called It's Better to Be Feared, the story of the Brady, Belichick, Robert Kraft, and the Patriots dynasty. Senior ESPN writer Seth Wickersham with us today. Thank you all, podcast family, for joining us. We appreciate you every week, and we'll see you next week. Thank you. Good night.
If I gave you the rest of your life to recreate that shot you made on the 10th hole, how long do you think you would be there before you made it again?
It would be the afterlife. When I made that shot, I'm not going to live long enough to make another shot like that.
I'm just curious, like if I literally just put a bucket of balls in front of you and you kept replenishing the bucket and you literally couldn't leave that spot and like I was like, do it again.
Right.
I'm wondering like how, like do you think you would have gotten out of there before like nighttime came? Like you had like another 8 hours of just constantly hitting shots. Like do you think you could have hit another one?
Maybe I'd get lucky one more time. I don't know, but I can tell you this. That was the length of a short par three. And in my lifetime, how many par threes have I played without a hole in one? So that's the answer.
I tell you one thing. If you kept drinking the Bloody Marys, you would never have even made it to nighttime.
You get that right. Wow.